This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. You'll often hear President Trump described as a populist or a nationalist, two terms that have popped up a lot since last year's election. Both have a long history in the U.S. and in other countries, and joining us to discuss nationalism and populism in America and abroad are University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. David Niven, and Miami University Department of History Professor Emeritus, Dr. Robert Thurston. You can join us 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. David, thank you for being here today. Good to see you.
It's my pleasure.
Bob, same to good to see you as always.
Pleasure to be here again, Mark.
Yeah, can we start off by a few definitions here?
Yes,
because they're kind of important to the whole conversation. Because I think people get these two things confused quite frequently.
Absolutely, populism is difficult to define. It's any kind of movement that advocates improvement for common people, and there's almost always an anti-elite component to it. But beyond that, all kinds of leaders have been called populists: Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, Mussolini, Stalin, Khrushchev in the Soviet Union, and now Donald Trump, of course. So it seems to apply to it. It's not a right-wing or a left-wing thing, and it's not necessarily something that always shades into nationalism, let alone fascism. Lately, what we've seen is a lot of right-wing nationalism in Europe, and I would say in this country as well. So it's a pretty vague term. It's also been called a thin ideology. That is, it has to be coupled with something else, nationalism, racism, in order to become much of a potent force. So it's a pretty vague term that's widely applied. Sometimes I think the only people who shouldn't be called nationalists are the monarchs of Europe or Asia or whatever. But even they talked about the welfare of the common people.
Okay, so nationalism sounds like the two things are almost cousins in a sense. A little difficult to distinguish. But typically when you talk about nationalism, what does that mean?
Well, the distinction is really, you know, the populism is an anti-elite force. And so, you know, it can go against all sorts of different directions. And you can make a good argument that Trump and Bernie Sanders were both populists in the last election, which really gives you an idea of how flexible that is.
Yeah, just coming at it from different angles of populism.
Right. And now nationalism, the distinguishing factor is, you know, is a borderline. And it can either be that physical border of the United States versus the world, or it can be, you know, kind of the idea of a place as superior to the alternatives around the world. So what they have in common, populism and nationalism, is they're both fundamentally an us versus them, but they're about different uses and different versions of them.
Yeah, it may help to talk a little bit more. I agree with what David is saying about nationalism. It comes from the Latin natic, to be born. So when you talk about, let's say, German nationalism under Hitler, that referred to the Germans as an ethnic group, as a biological entity, or that's the way the Nazis talked about it. When you talk about American nationalism, it's not necessarily tied, of course, to any one ethnic group. So it's certainly possible for American nationalism to become racist, to become virulent, but it's easier, I think, for things to slide in that direction when you're talking about one specific ethnic group, Germans, Italians, English, whatever, instead of Americans, who are this amazing hodgepodge of peoples.
So is it fair to say there are degrees of populism, there are degrees of nationalism, and that's what makes it so hard to put a specific definition on both these terms?
I think you can talk about degrees of nationalism. I don't know what David would say, but degrees of populism,
There's different targets of populism. I mean, populism is always there's an elite out there that's doing you wrong. But who that elite is going to vary depending mm-hmm. who's speaking. You know, it's going to vary quite tremendously.
Yeah.
You know, nationalism, you know, that fundamental importance of country, again, it gets at this us versus them, but it can be deployed in different ways. You know, to a certain extent, Obama would, you know, distinguish himself from Romney in 2012 on Romney's foreign investments. And that has a hint of nationalism to it. And yet it's a world away from the 2016 campaign and the way that Trump presented America versus the world.
Is there a difference between nationalism and patriotism?
I really think there is. But it may be kind of subtle. I mean, you can have patriotism that's not really stridently, the Germans are the best in the world. You can have a kind of quiet patriotism. I just want my country to be good and to get better, et cetera. It doesn't have to be a lot of demonstrative feeling. Nationalism is, I think, by a definition, more strident, more likely to wave a flag of a certain kind or promote a certain nation, of course, as being better than the other nations. So patriotism doesn't have to be tied to nationalism at all, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, David?
You know, I would agree. I think that you can feel very, very patriotic without necessarily focusing on what other countries lack or, you know, as you said, the stridency of it. You know, I can be a patriot for the United States and not harbor negative feelings about Canada. When, you know, you get to nationalism, then there's this implied superiority that comes along.
So that's where the us versus them thinking starts to come into play.
Right. And it gets much, much more strident that there has to be a number one and that the others are inferior and have to be, you know, have to be held at some distance and held at a lower regard.
I'd like to say one other thing, Mark, about populism and the elite. In general, yes, there's always this anti-elite component. However, if people who are engaged in populism think that a very wealthy person, Donald Trump, for example, is sort of one of theirs, he comes from them, then the populace don't resent that person in a big way. We've seen that in Latin America repeatedly, that very wealthy leaders are accepted by populists. And that was true in the United States in the 1890s when we had a real populist party, the biggest one ever in the world. And so, again, it's a very curious sort of phenomenon because it can be anti-elite, but at the same time accept someone. Trump says he's not of the elite, but I think he is. The populace can accept someone who is very wealthy and powerful if they feel that person has come somehow from their ranks, from within their group.
How far back do populism and nationalism date?
Well,
they've been around for a long time.
There's an old idea that if you go back far enough to, let's say, the 16th century in Europe, that religion was another term for nationalism. Were you a Protestant in some part of Germany? Were you a Catholic in Italy? So nationalism is typically dated from the French Revolution, 1789 on, when all of a sudden there's a tremendous feeling that, at least on paper and rhetoric, all French people are equal, all French people are good, all have equal opportunities. Well, not the women so much, but that's usually when modern nationalism is dated.
Certainly in this country, you know, populism, Andrew Jackson is credited with you know, fomenting that feeling, you know, in the 1830s. You know, in terms of nationalist feelings, I mean, they predate the country. I mean, the idea of America is central to the sales pitch that later creates the country. So, you know, it wasn't quite the same fashion that we know it today, but there were still hints of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, why the recent focus on these two ideologies? Did this start with Brexit and Trump? Were those what kicked off the recent attention to populism and nationalism?
Well, certainly Trump has a lot to do with it, and he's a great illustration of how flexible these approaches can be employed. You know, that you could run as a billionaire anti-elitist sounds on its surface silly, but you know, it really, that populism is, there's an elite out there that's harming you, and then the leader points to something, and that, you know, think about how different it was when Bernie Sanders points to who's the elite hurting you versus Donald Trump, who's the elite hurting you. You know, they're entirely different groups. There's the Venn diagram doesn't overlap at all on that.
Now, I would say that the Brexit vote, which was June of 2016, kicked off the latest round of concern about nationalism and populism. The vote in Britain was very close, 52% for leaving the European Union. But some part of that vote to leave has often been analyzed as just pro-British feeling, and especially pro-English feeling, because the Scots voted to stay in the EU. In Northern Ireland, they voted to stay in. Wales voted against, voted to leave a little bit. So this is often described as, again, just good old England. We're going to vote for England, nationalism in that sense. And then the recent votes in France, for example, May 2017, where Marine Le Pen and her right-wing nationalist anti-immigrant party got 34% of the vote. That's the highest that a right-wing anti-immigrant party has ever gotten in France. The party in Germany, Alternative for Germany, it has seats in the Reichstag, the German parliament, first time since World War II that a right-wing party, anti-immigrant, has had any seats in the German parliament. So, and somewhat similar trends in Poland, Hungary, et cetera. So all this is not brand new, but it's new manifestations of a populist rightist feeling in Europe.
So it's fair to say that this is growing. That nationalism and populism are growing in the world.
They have an appeal, and it, you know, it goes far beyond the United States. You know, it crosses the globe, and you know it's something that captures people's imagination, you know, as a means of grievance and uniting people in a common grievance. You know, it's typically these are being, you know, deployed, you know, in an inherent, you know, sort of rebellious and you know, angry mood, which obviously captures not just attention, but also a lot of fears of folks across the world.
So when people are disgruntled and dissatisfied, that's when you're likely to see these two movements gaining strength.
Yes, and the other big factor that promoted populism and right-wing populism in Europe was the mass immigration from North Africa and from Syria. And when thousands of refugees appeared all of a sudden, it really stoked these feelings in all kinds of places that we, the good people, whatever, Germans, Poles, ethnic Hungarians, that we're sort of under assault by these other people who, yes, they've fled a terrible situation, but they're not like us. They're different. They're Muslims. And all kinds of reports out of Germany, which are not well substantiated, that, oh, these refugees commit a much higher proportion of crimes than our own ethnic Germans do, that kind of thing. So a lot of negative reporting and a lot of very bad reactions to the refugee crisis.
Yeah, and in terms of how we view the terms nationalism, populism, they're typically seen as being negatives. Is that correct?
Yeah, it depends on your point of view. Yeah.
Well, it's hard to run on joyful populism when the whole premise of it is
you're disgruntled and dissatisfied.
Right, you've identified an elite that's holding you back. So you don't hear a lot about joyful populism. You know, I mean, one of the intriguing things about all this, certainly in the United States, you know, it's easy to think this is about economic grievance and it's about immigration and the sort of fears of a changing country. But you know, the reality of how people vote. You know, Trump's voters, by and large, were not the sufferers of this economy. I mean, you know, his voters were slightly better off than you would expect if you were just thinking this is about economic grievance. And then, of course, ironically, he gains the most support in places that have the least immigration. And, you know, places like California, of course, he has very little support at all. So, I mean, part of what you're seeing around the globe isn't necessarily the realities of immigration or the realities of economic displacement, yeah, but the artful use of those things to generate a response.
I'd like to add one other factor that I think is important but is not mentioned very often in discussions of nationalism and populism lately, and that's what's called the total fertility rate. This is the number of births per woman ages 15 to 49. And all over Europe and the United States, there aren't enough births among the inhabitants of any country to renew the population. You would have to have 2.01 births at a minimum to renew the population. In the United Kingdom, it's 1.81, Germany 1.5. Even the U.S., the latest figures I've seen are 1.87. So again, too low to replenish the population. And I think that this works in, compare Niger, the country with the highest total fertility rate, almost 6.5 babies per woman of fertile age. And I think what this does is makes the people who are already in the country, especially, frankly, white Christians, feel that they are under attack. They're going to be swamped by these newcomers. And there are many more of the newcomers. And by the way, this is an old idea in the United States, the anti-immigrant sentiment of the 1880s and 90s, and even the idea in the early 20th century that the Anglo-Saxons of America were committing race suicide because they didn't reproduce nearly as fast as the new immigrants from Eastern Europe. So I think this is part of the background, the idea that we, whoever we are, the good people, are losing in this demographic race to these newcomers.
How concerned, Bob, should people be about the populist sentiment, nationalist sentiment?
Well, it's interesting that in a number of countries in Europe, again, for the first time, this alternative for Germany has seats in the Reichstag. It's never seen that before. And the anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant party in the Netherlands, led by Geert Wilders, the name looks like Wilders, has 20 seats out of 150. But a lot of observers think that this tendency may have peaked already. Everybody was afraid after the Brexit, or a lot of people were afraid after the Brexit vote, that there would just be more and more of a slide toward nationalism and populism. That hasn't happened. So it depends on your point of view, but if you're concerned about racism and anti-immigrant feelings, then there's certainly still cause to be very concerned about right-wing populism. But on the other hand, no party in Western Europe has accumulated very much of the vote yet. So we shall see.
What are your thoughts, David?
Well, you know, I think anytime a politics of us versus them takes hold, everybody has to be concerned, whether you're in the them or not. And, you know, it's really the founding premise of our Constitution was to protect the thems, that, you know, when the us's took power, that they couldn't ignore the rights of the folks on the outside. So I think that the concern is twofold. One is a politics of us versus them is frightening on its face. The second is how easy it is to manipulate. Once you get people fired and stoked about this notion that there's an enemy, you know, how easy it is to manipulate the politics around that and really pursue with any policy path you want. And that one of the things that you see in, a little bit in this conversation, populism doesn't equal a set of policy proposals, and nationalism doesn't. It's fundamentally a means of getting people angry, and then you've spooned them the policies you wanted to do in the first place.
And I would just add one thing to that. I certainly agree. And the tendency toward authoritarian rule can go hand in hand with all of this. That's what's happening in Poland and Hungary, for example. The emphasis on we are the Polish nation and we don't like these immigrants at all, we won't have them here, is coupled with an increasing tendency to control the court system and the media in Poland and to rule in an authoritarian way.
Bob and David, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. David Niven, and Miami University Department of History, Professor Emeritus, Dr. Robert Thurston.